content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the fiction section of the February 9th, 2026 issue of the New Yorker. This is How It Happens by Molly Aiken. It is Wednesday, or a Tuesday, just one of those nondescript midweek days in February, when all you have to look forward to is a weekend spent in bed attempting to stroke your feral cat. It is 1982. At least this you are sure of. You are leaving work, your suit still damp from the morning's downpour, the skin on your palms peeling. You are clutching two supermarket bags, tins of cream soup and tuna knocking against one another. The rain is hard, and your anorak is cheap. You are on your way to Stockbridge, to your parents' house, which only your father inhabits now that your mother is gone. There you will find, no doubt, a cold potato salad gifted by a kind neighbor, the lingering smell of pipe smoke in the hall, and a delighted expression on the dog's face when your father opens the front door. You walk slowly, looking down at your sodden loafers. And so it is her toes you see first, bare against the gray slabs of the Edinburgh street, each nail painted orange. She is wearing an orange skirt and an orange jumper, too. Behind her, there are four more people, all dressed in various shades of orange. Their ages range from about 25 to 60, and yet their faces remind you of the youthful hilarity and sweetness of a school photo, all snaggle teeth, mad hair, and crooked glasses. The barefoot one darts forward and drops a wet leaflet into one of your shopping bags. She is around your age, the youngest of them. Despite the rain, her neck is grimy. You imagine getting a soapy rag and scrubbing at her. "Nice mustache," she says, and then, "Anything good in there?" She is pointing at your shopping bags. Cream cheese, wine, a bunch of excessively perky daffodils you bought for your father. Already, she has turned back to the others, the man with a dark beard and a hunter's eyes, the woman in her 50s with dank gray hair, the young man with a shaved head who keeps whispering to the others, and the tanned, ageless one. Now, the man with the beard and the eyes approaches you. "Come back with us," he holds out his hand. You want to take it, but your hands are flaking with eczema, so instead you pass him a shopping bag, realizing too late that, in doing so, you have accepted that you will now either lose your shopping or follow it home with him. Their place is a typical new town flat, soaring ceilings and peeling floral 50s wallpaper. It is so similar to the wallpaper in your father's home that at first your instinct is to run. The barefoot girl, who calls herself Ma, takes your bag from the bearded man and holds out her free hand for the shopping you are still clutching. You give it to her and watch as she tosses your father's daffodils into the kitchen sink. She crows over the tins of tuna. "Four!" Back at your flat, your cat will be yowling for those tins, but you try not to think about him. There are two people here who weren't on the street. They look a little younger than you and Ma. You find that you like them. Ma puts the red wine to one side, ignores the shortbread, and scoops a glob of cream cheese onto her fingertip. You copy her, and she laughs. "Be yourself," she says. She's one of those rare things, a woman who is not nice. The others are hurriedly opening your food. They eat it without thanking you. The one with the beard and the eyes says that his name is Jitendra. You wait for him to ask your name, but he doesn't. He complains that the wine isn't white. You apologize, and he nods, pours himself a large glass anyway, and tells you that you are handsome. You sit beside Ma on the floor, clutching a mug of tea. You won't drink it. The milk is off. You could tell when she poured it. Silk scarves have been thrown over the many lampshades, and a candle is burning low on a coffee table. The whole place is a fire hazard. The air has that sickening smell of dried fruit. It reminds you of the long car journeys you used to take as a child, your parents' arguments and silences, your father quietly leaving the holiday home in the night, your mother laughing, then crying, then forgetting to cook dinner. So you ate bread and apples and befriended a stray sheep. Ma strides about the room, waving incense. You want to laugh. You think about what it would be like to kiss her. You feel that you have kissed too few people in your 26 years. That time in the work tea room when a girl pressed her dry mouth through yours and bluntly professed her love. You mumbled words of thanks and scurried off to an early lunch. You knew that she was the type of girl you were meant to take home. Your father would have congratulated you on her looks. Your mother would have complained about how ordinary she was and made your visits difficult. You knew you did not have the stamina for her. She would want things from you. You take a few inexpert drags on the spliff that Chitandra passes to you. They all start chanting. You are too self-conscious to join in. You can't help but watch Chitandra. He looks a little like you, except that he has dark hair, hair that makes you think about the comb in your pocket. He sits cross-legged, and he sways, easeful and relaxed. You are not like him at all. The ageless one and a young man with glasses leave for an adjoining bedroom and have sex quietly, but not quietly enough. The others chant for a full hour. Toward the end of that hour, you stop checking your watch and find that you are swaying slightly, that the chant is reverberating in you, even in your feet. It was probably 2 months ago that you went alone to the cinema to watch that documentary. You assume that these new acquaintances are part of that same group, because the people in the documentary also wore orange, when they wore clothes at all. You remember sitting beside the others in the cinema, so rigid and repulsed and turned on. They stop chanting to eat crackers and eventually to sleep. You lie down on one of two sofas, and to your surprise, you feel comfortable. Ma crawls toward you and plants her palms on your cheeks. Her mouth tastes foul. Sunrise reveals cobwebs everywhere. You have slept. Right now, your cat is probably shredding your bedspread in a ravenous rage. It is time to leave. Chitandra and one of the young ones are up and dressed as if they have jobs to get to, like you. Chitandra even wears a navy suit. He tells you that he is a doctor. You consider asking him to pay you back for the groceries, but don't. You tell Ma your address, but don't expect her to remember it. Never mind to actually brave the streets of Leith with the junkies and the prostitutes. You chose your flat because it was affordable and because, up until the age of 19, when you moved out of your parents' house, nothing much had happened to you. At your office, you shuffle papers, send a fax, make tea, open another packet of biscuits, and hand them out. Everyone smiles without quite meeting your gaze, and you realize that you can't describe in any detail what your colleagues look like. Not even the girl who kissed you in the tea room. After work, you walk over to your father's house to apologize for not appearing the night before. The garden is a soup of mud and trampled grass. As you expected, he isn't there. So you leave a note saying, "Tea at Jenner's on Sunday, 11:30. That evening, Ma coos to your cat. She finds it creepy that you left the plastic cover on your sofa. She says that your flat is oppressive, that she feels unwelcome in the kitchen, but you notice that she feels comfortable enough to empty your fridge, eating what she can and putting the rest in a plastic bag to take away with her. You ask her what her childhood was like. Normal, why? You imagine that she had three older brothers and they were all violent. You meet your father for that tea in Jenner's. He looks like himself. Clipped mustache, tweed suit, a smoker's fingernails. He does not shake your hand. Immediately, he begins a monologue about your dead mother, how she hated him when they first met, and on many occasions after they were married. What a good lover she was, how irrational she was, how much he adored her. You try to avoid eye contact with the other customers. Your neck feels hot, and you hate that your father has this effect on your body. "We were like a pair of kittens climbing all over each other," he says. You know you will carry this horrifying image with you for the rest of your life. "Your shirt is very orange," he notes, putting his tea down. But he goes straight back to the subject of your mother, and you press the crumbs from your scone into the pad of your finger. You have sex with Ma without kissing her mouth. She doesn't mention the eczema all over your body. She is wearing an orange silk slip, a dicey choice for February, especially as you keep a fire going only in the little sitting room, because that's where you and the cat spend most of your time. She tells you that the slip was her grandmother's, and that she made the dye from tree bark she stole from the Royal Botanic Garden. Over the next few weeks, she starts dyeing your white clothes, too, and one day all your dark suits have vanished. You find your best black slacks in a charity shop at the top of Leith Walk and have to repurchase them at an embarrassingly low price. Ma has told you that she's with Jitendra. You have come to like him. Her Indian name, Ma Mariam, like Jitendra's, was given to her by the guru. She refuses to tell you the name on her passport. She says that she will change it legally as soon as she has the cash. Perhaps Ma is a student or a trainee like most of the others. You haven't asked. Jitendra gives you answers to all your questions. A few times, he massages your shoulders as he speaks to you, and you notice that you feel loose, relaxed even, around him. With him you talk, and with Ma you have quite ordinary sex. You stay at their flat more and more, stopping at home just to feed your cat. In the mornings, before Jitendra goes to his practice and you to the office, you sit with your cups of tea and play drafts. You don't know exactly when it happens, but you find that you are one of them. You haven't been to the barber in weeks. You have a beard for the first time in your life. You sense that you will soon be let go from work. There have been comments about your wardrobe and how often you are late. But it doesn't bother you, even though you know it should. You will have to give up your tiny flat, but you will just move into theirs. It has plenty of room. It will be fine. The only thing that concerns you is your cat. You are not sure how they will treat him. They are careless. No doubt one of them will bring home a plant that's poisonous for felines. It would be just like them to, on a whim, without checking with you, become indoor plant people. One evening, you manage to persuade Ma to get into your bath because you have seen the state of the bathtub where she lives. She reappears pink and soft and far too young-looking. You realize you prefer her dirty. Since you started wearing orange, your cat has been treating you with disdain. Sometimes you don't see him for days. He hisses and spits from under your bed, and you are afraid to get out in the morning because there is no doubt in your mind that he will scratch your bare ankles. You take flying leaps off your mattress and hurt your knees. Not for the first time, you despair at having somehow chosen a beast that is so vicious. But when you got him, as a kitten, he seemed like all the others. Your father leaves a message on your answering machine inviting you to a whiskey evening. You don't phone him back. Out of nowhere, Ma says to your cat, "I used to ignore my father, and now he's dead." It's the most lucid thing she has ever said. Ma tells you, "We're leaving you soon," and you struggle not to cry because you have not even managed to quit your job and move in with them yet. Ma does not invite you. Jitendra doesn't either, not even when you ask him about it. You had thought the two of you were close. You don't cry. You get a pint with an old school friend, but that is a mistake because all he wants to talk about is your parents and how much he misses them, your mother. He is so sorry about your mother. You drink too fast and wake up in the morning on your sofa, your feet bare and covered in scratches. At your father's house, the dog tumbles out the door to lick your ankles. Your father looks tired, and you remember that you didn't go to his whiskey evening. You are holding a cardboard box with a few air holes punctured in the top. "I forgot you had a cat," he says. "Come in, come in." You follow. The dog bounces near your feet. You reel off your instructions. Feed the cat twice a day. Never allow him out of the house. Don't attempt to trim his nails. You will regret it. "It's just 2 weeks," you tell the cat. The kitchen is uncannily clean. When you were a child, the place was always in a relentless state of disarray. There were always raised voices of one kind or another, always dirty cups in the sink, and random forks on the sofa. "Holiday, then?" he lights his pipe. "With some friends." You open the flaps of the cardboard box, and the cat streaks out, leaps up onto the kitchen counter, and begins lapping from the dripping tap. It's as if he had always lived in this house. "Don't worry," your father says, blowing smoke over your head. "I'll take care of him." Oregon. Heat ricocheting off solid soil. Flies crawling into ears and over toes. Stacks of newly planed wood, smelling of sap, ready to build with. Warm apples. Sex. Too much beer. Too little rice. Filthy children on the verge of killing a butterfly or a mouse. You are different here. Yes, definitely different. Your Scottish skin is mottled with freckles. The eczema has retreated somewhere. You hope for good. Here you are touched by everyone, skin on skin, almost constantly. Tonight you are in the meditation hall. You haven't opened your eyes. You mustn't, because it would break the magic. No one has used that word with you, magic. But that's what it is, inexplicable and, at times, terrifying. Despite yourself, you open your eyes, gaze into your lap, and find an erection poking up at you. You wonder whether you can make yourself come without moving, without touch. It feels like an extreme effort to orgasm in this heat. You will let the erection go on or wither on its own. You have been having sex with so many women, some who were once lawyers or doctors or scientists, some younger, like Ma, who were teachers or waitresses or still just daughters when they came here. You have had so much sex that you got a rash, not eczema, it was something else, and you had to leave this place, which you have helped to build, and get a bus to another town to see a doctor who did not know you. To him, you said out loud your new name. It feels like yours now, even though you'd never heard it before your guru presented it to you. You queued, along with many others, just to have a brief few moments with him. You haven't admitted this to anyone, hardly even to yourself, but you were underwhelmed by the reality of him. Softer, feebler even, than you expected. Nothing like the sharp-eyed creature you saw at a distance. You think of the evening after you graduated from university. Your father had been drinking at dinner. So had you. You were sitting beside him on the sofa, and then you were getting up to leave, and his arms shot around you and grasped you tight and held on. The next morning, after breakfast, you realized that he had been hugging you. It's been almost a year, and you rarely think about your cat now, except when you see the white scars on your tanned feet. You know that some people here have sent postcards home, but you have not. There is no point, really. What would you even say, except to ask after the cat? You have not seen Jitendra since you arrived. You asked Ma when you first bumped into her again, and she shrugged and said that he'd gone back to his family. Sometimes Ma serves you dinner or sits near you in a circle around a fire on a summer night. But beyond that, you barely interact with her. you have not had sex with her once since you got here. Often she is with the children. You know that she uses a damp cloth to wipe their faces and hands, and even sleeps in the house that is meant only for children, regularly bellowing at them to be gentle. You can't help noticing that none of them seem to cut their nails. All of them are covered in scratches at different stages of bleeding or not bleeding. In Scotland, Ma did not seem like the maternal type, but here she is ordinary, mundane even. She blends in. You, on the other hand, you are so beautiful now. Your body is bigger. You take up more space. Your skin is smooth, except for the calluses on your hands from sawing wood. Everyone loves you here. Most days, you are pretty sure of that. Everyone touches you all the time. For the first time in your life, you experience long, intimate hugs with other men. Men who have no interest in effing you, you have no interest in effing them, either. But you slap each other's shoulders after building a new chicken coop. They also wrap their arms around you after meditation. A man kissed you on both cheeks when you woke up shouting one night. At first, it was bizarre and glorious. But now, the feeling of this love has become comfortable, lived in. You are so deeply proud of all of them, and they are proud of you. What you are all doing here is extraordinary. You find yourself reaching for them too, embracing them, telling them you love them. You find yourself looking up at the sky constantly, even when the sun is blinding. One evening, you tell a group of children about the pet sheep you briefly had on holiday as a child. A tiny boy pulls your sleeve and says that he wants a sheep. You have no idea where to buy a sheep in Oregon. You don't tell them about your cat. They don't seem old enough somehow. You take to rolling the youngest children in blankets and carrying them around over one shoulder. You sense a ravenous need in them to be held. Even some of the older children beg you for a turn, so you enlist other men to help you. You see the brief joy on their grimy faces afterward, and wonder if any children have run away from here. You ask yourself who would look for them if they did, and if they would ever be found. You want to meditate, to empty yourself again. But then the next child comes to you and says, "Please, big man, hold me." It's morning. You haven't slept, but you're not sure why. The light is red and the trees purple. The tarmac is warm beneath your bare feet. You haven't spoken to Ma in months, but she's running towards you, empty arms waving. "Your dad is here," she says. You go back to the house you share with some people, smoke a cigarette, eat some peanuts, weed a greenhouse. Stop. You just stop. You go to the guru's private garden because sometimes you weed there. Your father is in the garden, kneeling beside him. The guru speaks into your father's ear, his hand patting and stroking your father's shoulder. And you feel a lethal rage because there you are deadheading his effing roses, and you have never been touched by him, never touched him, not once. "Malcolm," your father shouts. You sit on the sun-blistered grass together. His nose is smeared with a white strip of sun cream. Ma is walking up the road toward the guru's big house. "See that girl with the shoes on?" you say. "What made you think it would work with her?" your father asks. "What makes you think it didn't?" "Ha!" You know he's thinking that Ma is like your mother. You are both thinking that it has been 3 years now without her. Neither of you expected her. Not of her. Without ever speaking about it, you had both assumed that she would go noisily in a freak hiking accident or a plane crash. Not with the quietness of a disease already in her brain. Not drugged and almost constantly sleeping. Within a week, she could not speak. Before that, wherever she went, tender and trampling through your lives, there was always the sound of bangle against bangle on her wrists. You look down at your strong, freckled arms, your hands in your lap. You look up at the sky. It's blue, mottled by clouds. You don't ask how your father found you. Your parents always seem to know someone in every city. The endless dinner parties, the constant chatter and music. You suppose it was only a matter of time, and you laugh. How's my cat? She's dead. He's dead. A warm hand takes your hand, and you think how nice it is, in the end, to be touched by a man like your father. Now, from the May 26, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, fiction section, Fairy Pools, by Patricia Lockwood. As soon as she touched down in Scotland, she believed in fairies. No, as soon as the rock and velvet of Inverness rushed up to her where she was falling, a long way through the Hagstone hole of a cloud, and she plunged down into the center of the cloud and stayed there. You used to set a child out for them, she thought, and was caught in the arms and awoke on the green hillside. Scotland, she heard her mother say in a voice weak from lack of iced tea. They were barely alive after 5 hours on the runway in Chicago and another 10 in the air. It's not the first real day, her husband kept reminding them. After a short stay in Inverness that night, they would go on to Skye tomorrow. He jangled a set of keys. In Ireland, 2 years before, it had transpired that her husband, a contrarian, was born to drive on the wrong side of the road, while her mother, a worse contrarian, whom she had defeated by marrying the former, planned to drag them all to hell that way. I'll drive, he told her mother now, very loudly, and you sit on the passenger side and slam your foot to the floor whenever I get too close to a low stone wall. Deal, her mother agreed. She would also provide commentary and throw in those sharp little gasps for free. As for her, she was silent and let herself be carried on and on toward the green hillside. The trees corresponded to an obsessive high school reading of The White Goddess. The sheep were spray-painted according to who owned them. Actual lambs frisked in the fields and legs like little girls. Wait, she thought. Am I confused about changelings? You put them out. Did you get anything back? Or were they taken from you in the night and you woke up one morning? Her sister sat apart from her in the rental car. Her head was full of the child, her child, who had been lost to them all just that January. From time to time, she saw her sister flicking through pictures on her phone with a chipped hot pink manicure, so quickly that the child appeared to be alive. It was as if her sister were smoothing a forehead, or touching away an eyelash, or wiping milk from a mouth, and once again the whole life was in motion. "Wide load," she heard her mother saying to the asses of the sheep, as if they were women. Upon arrival at the hotel, instead of taking pictures of the North Sea, she took pictures of elk bellowing on the walls and a little guy who appeared to be penetrating his bagpipes. This was her typical routine in other countries, to first take pictures of their pictures. It was a way of entering into the spirit, as was eating the complimentary oatcakes that had been left in your room, with its conscious and unconscious plaids. Light, shadow, her hand crossed over her sister's, and that life called through the window. Which called them out? She picked up a stone from the shore of the North Sea with a ring of mica around it top, flashing like the city on the water, and they piled into the car to go looking for it, wrapped in a series of preposterous scarves. When she thought of changelings, wasn't it mostly of the way they were wrapped in rough gray cloth with a triangle of face shining through? Between the time her mother had gone into her hotel room and the time she reappeared in the hall, her jeans had become wet. They would not dry for the rest of the trip. The wetness came to represent, in their minds, the iced tea she could never get. "Tea with ice?" she would ask hopefully, making a series of gestures to communicate the concept of iced tea, and would be brought a cup with 3 cubes in it by someone who looked almost medically concerned. "Tea with ice?" she asked at the Jamaican restaurant, holding up her hands like shocked daisies next to her eyes. They had gone to 3 or 4 places before finding one that was open. The chef, in a white hat, laughed and entered her mother's conspiracy. The night flowed like chest-struck oil outside the windows. She tried to fix the details of it in her mind. She never remembered the first night in another country. It was as if the change in altitude threw her off, or she really had touched down in another world. The restaurant, she would not remember later, was actually called Cool Runnings. Back at the hotel bar, the bartender told them the lamentable story of Irn Bru. It had once been sweeter, now it was less sweet. There were petitions and people hoarding it by the case in their flats. She ordered a can from him to make friends, for she saw no other way of doing it. Scottish bartenders had been given the opposite instructions to American ones. The taste, a pink electrocution of the tongue, was indescribable. And there was a version that was more so? She decided that if she were presented with a petition, she would sign it, and also support Scottish independence, if that was correct. Maybe now that they were friends, she could ask the bartender. "But tea with ice?" her mother asked him, and the chance was gone. And so that was Loch Ness. She followed her sister through the ruins of the castle that overlooked it, taking pictures of her in empty windows, her gold hair whipped, her pink lipstick drawn far beyond the outline of her mouth, smiled without her. People had really lived here. Could you still surprise someone's breathing near the ceiling as you could upstairs in her sister's house? How long did that last? Her husband rubbed his hands. Finally, a country where the women were wearing enough cloth and where the wind persisted in exposing the tips of their ears. He had turned to pure itinerary. His mind was full of mileage, national parks, famed distilleries, tallest peaks. At this point, he believed he was Scottish. Everywhere they went, they saw bald heads that looked like his. "One of me," he would cry, pointing them out. A country full of thousands, and she had reached out and taken one. She fondled the mica stone. Maybe the soul was just that dearness nestled in the center of the body, like a chosen pebble in the palm of a hand. When you held someone, it was that dearness you felt, that choseness. And he was dear. He would sniff the air and stop the car and say, "Macbeth lived here." He knew where there was Red Bull and where there might be ice, 3 cubes of it for her mother. In the car, they played a game of Would You Rather, except they misremembered it as I Would Never. This limited things somewhat. Her husband won easily. "I would never do that," he kept shouting, and then put down another point for himself. He had done all this to rinse her sister's mind of pain. Pain was one of the things he could not stand, along with Muppets and receipts, which were endocrine disruptors. "No, thank you," he said to the man at the gas station when he purchased 4 cans of the less sweet Irn Bru. "Keep moving," he told them all in his long, striding body, 1 foot in front of the other, "or die." She did what she always did in a car, looked out the window, trusted, and let herself be carried along. The easiest life to imagine was the life of the postman. The easiest life to imagine was the life of the man who ran the ferry. The easiest life to imagine was that of a child in the castle that sat on the shore of Loch Ness, where the water was full, it was true, of little slipping necks. You could just grab on. They took turns reading aloud from Wikipedia about fighting hares, the symbology of thistles, which time of year the heather bloomed. The list of historical guys who actually believed in fairies was pretty long. She told them on the way to Glenbrittle. Her husband would have to update her entry to say that she had joined it. "Did you ever see a fairy's funeral, madam?" said Blake to a lady who happened to sit next to him. "Never, sir," said the lady. "I have," said Blake, "but not before last night." And he went on to tell how, in his garden, he had seen a procession of creatures of the size and color of green and gray grasshoppers, bearing a body laid out on a rose leaf, which they buried with songs, and then disappeared. The fairy pools had been poured down. The walk up was like a slow exploration of the skeleton of an animal, whose life was reenacted here and there by plunges of crystal water. There were natural bridges, caves heaped with uniform gray treasure, keyholes of bloodstone-colored water, raindrops on the lens, trees clinging to cliffs, the falls too fast for cameras, like fairies, and the long natural stairs that her sister climbed. People spoke every language. Europeans, who knew which laws to disregard, were stripping off their clothes and swimming. You could pose with a red bull next to the tallest waterfall and make it seem like you were peeing. A perfect place. They drank the water. Her husband sat on the edge of the deepest pool, which touched the center of the earth, and scooped it into a survivalist water filter he had bought on the internet. "This will let you drink water from anywhere, in any situation," he had told her intensely when it arrived in the mail. More and more of these situations were arising. As a child, she had watched Kevin Costner drink his own freshly distilled piss in Waterworld and just assumed it was something she would have to do as an adult, for the world would be different. They all drank a long swallow of the cool, clear water, which was somehow inflected with the word green. It went clear into the center of her, through the hagstone hole and the natural arch, plunging down the stairs of living rock. Inside her, Europeans stripped and splashed. "Now we are refreshed," he said. "Now we can go on." 20 pictures in her photo roll later, her sister's phone disappeared. Her black and white scarf and her rose gold phone with the child's whole short life on it. It had been in the hospital with them, in her right hand, always. It had been what the next phone would not be, a warm eyewitness. Her sister was holding it in one picture, and then she wasn't. A bald mountain behind her, her face closed, impassible, there and then gone. "I can find it," she told her sister, desperate. She always had $5 in a parking lot, when that was real money. But there had been a switch. When she went up, the pools had looked one way, but when she came down again, searching for the rose gold phone, they looked another way. As if they were a story that needed to be told in order from the beginning without leaving anything out. Maybe this place was like the world. You could travel through it only once. She rolled her ankle on the rocks. An hour passed, and then another. "As soon as we get back in cell phone range," her husband kept telling them, "we can just call." But no one listened. Her sister's sear hair went among the grasses. Her head was full of the child. "We shouldn't have drunk the water," they would say later. It had angered the fairies. No, not angered. They had simply demanded something in exchange. But as soon as they saw what was on the phone, the face, the flicking motion, they'd know it was too much. They would give it back and keep only the scarf, which was just from Target. She fondled the mica stone. It stayed in her right hand always. She had picked up others along the way, on the shore of Loch Ness, while bouldering in Slingachong, and at the roadside stop where a horse had lifted up her sweater to nuzzle her belly as if he loved her. Maybe she was preparing to build a cairn, which, in their miniature versions, were everywhere. They snagged her eye, always. How did they stand? The balancing of the tallest cairns seemed to indicate that there were properties of physics we did not understand, or else they had been overruled by the Earth's desire to be surprising. The feeling that she was not quite herself began as they approached Glenfinnan. Her body went ahead of her into the church, rippling with bottle-brown light. "In Bru," she thought. "Sign the petition." Her eyes, floating a little in their sockets, went on looking. A vase with two daffodils, a statue begging for money, a historical plaque next to photos of water damage on the pillars, which at one point had had to be replaced. Not an easy task considering the size and weight of the stones and the height, the plaque yelled. We never want to see this again. Ha ha, she heard herself saying, and placed a coin in the little plaster purse. The feeling intensified at the information center, where she found herself sliding down the wall with headphones on while listening to an interminable murder ballad. It came to her. She was being murdered. The bridge overhead was bearing down on her. The church was falling toward her with its spire. Her skin in the bathroom mirror? We never want to see this again, she thought. Where have you been? Her husband asked when she emerged 20 minutes later. It was strange to know that when something was really wrong with her, no one would be able to tell. Faster, she told them in a monotone as her husband sped the car toward the castle. Something was going to happen. She didn't know what. After they checked in, she sat with the others for 10 minutes on the terrace, from which they could see the sun spilling like Chardonnay into the spread of the hills. The landscape appeared to her as one in which she was being hunted. Good night, she told them formally in the monotone, and went upstairs. Something was going to happen. A maid came to the door and asked her if she wanted something untranslatable. Her mouth, pale in a cameo face, formed the words several times. I cannot understand you, she finally said, weeping. Then, as she closed the door, it came to her. Turndown service. A little chocolate in the center of the pillow. The maid was Eastern European, and all at once she felt like four segments of an orange, the rotation of the world that had brought her here, and she stumbled out into the hall to say that it wasn't the accent. It was a problem with all language. Bathroom, she thought. I live in the bathroom. And she went to press her face against the rug. Why were the fairy pools so green, she wondered, and rose to her knees and ejected a long green waterfall into the trash can. Shall not mine true love stay with me when I am hurling, she thought. For she had suddenly remembered about the existence of Old English. What was under her legs now? What was carrying her to the bed? It was the old mistaken movement of the word moor. Arranging her head in the center of the pillow like a mint, she took a series of pictures as proof. She would show them all later, how close to death she had come, and leaned over like a cliff to release another waterfall. Arugula, she thought. I'm going to die alone in a Scottish castle because people have gotten too good for iceberg lettuce. Then remembered the Jamaican restaurant that the chef had kept open for them on that first night, bringing them mussels and baby clams and the firm cheeks of something that had no name. Could be, she thought, remembering how her husband always insisted she had a shellfish allergy, which she would not or could not accept. But she kept coming back to the coldest water in the world, which had gone down into the center of her, which belonged then and now to the fairies. Effing survivalist, she thought. Fancy cups, bug eating, no respect. They think they're preparing for any contingency, but they have no idea. They think regional camo will protect them. They think they're ready to leave the weak ones behind in the woods. They think there'll be no money. Her body was so heavy. The child was in all her limbs. She was carrying her through thickets and over green hills, laying her down nowhere or else she would be taken. If she could feel her, as she had never before been able to feel anybody on this earth, it was because the child was the right size. Why had no one been the right size before? The door opened. A shape passed by her, neatly tied up her arugula and made it disappear. Downstairs on the fairy tale terrace, over an exorbitant Scottish cheese board, her mother and husband and sister were all screaming at one another. Her mother had misread something about the Property Brothers on the internet and was insisting that they were being persecuted for being Christian. Their show had been canceled, she shouted, because of their embrace of the true faith. Her husband explained that they were Canadians, and Canadians did not have faith. But she got redder and redder, believing that he was concealing reality from her. It was the Property Brothers, and they had lost it all. That was the sort of mistake people made now. It was hard to know how much to yell at her about it, because one day she would die. Also, she had taken care of the child. You had to think of her hands cupping the large head, and how one day the child had let her head fall forward. It seemed purposefully, so that her open mouth landed smack against her grandmother's cheek. They decided to call that a kiss, for narrative purposes. They made many such decisions in those days. Gossip was the life of a castle, and by the next morning everyone knew. "Are you all right?" a series of pale, cameo-faced women asked her, bending tenderly over her at breakfast. Any one of them could have been the woman at the door, trying to give her the mint that she could not receive. Her mother, too, looked a little green around the edges. The brothers, meekly, were not mentioned. She thought of the phrase, throwing up your toenails. She thought of her mother counting hers, though it had been her husband who came in the end, hadn't it, tiptoeing out of the castle at midnight with a bag of homemade pesto in one hand. They stopped at a store where the owner had decorated his display cases with blocks of movable type, and her sister asked if he would sell her four letters of it, but he would not. That was what was smallest in the world, she thought. Not atoms, but movable type. And you could not buy four letters of it for any price. "Thank you anyway," her sister said politely. "My daughter," she said, turning away and walking past the case again, where by some chance the atoms actually spelled out the child's name. "Let's turn here," her husband said thoughtfully as they passed a sign that said, "Rob Roy." "What about him?" they all wondered. "Hadn't he been the guy in that film, played by Liam Neeson, before he made a whole career of his children being taken, with a big blouse, and maybe he shouted, 'Freedom!'" It was his grave. Everyone who had been there before them seemed to know and had left coins and scraps of tartan and white daffodils for him. The headstone read, "MacGregor despite them," which was even more confusing. The daffodils, her husband reported, might have been because of Wordsworth, who had written a long poem about coming here once. "Forgive me if the phrase be strong, a poet worthy of Rob Roy must scorn a timid song." "Whatever that means," he said, looking at his phone. The movie poster was two people breathing into each other's mouth, flashing sword fights, land disputes, and nighttime raids in what looked to be a long male ponytail. One of the most famous figures in Scottish history. "Wait, really?" they asked one another. The hand of anonymity closed around them, squeezed. Was it possible that only a name could be passed down? Her mother stalked the perimeter of the grave, faced with a philosophical question: how to take pictures of the ass of a ghost. "We should commemorate him," her sister said solemnly. A bridge stretched between the place where the body was buried and where it was not, and she and her sister walked over it, arm in arm. They peed in the woods behind the church, thereby linking themselves bodily with Rob Roy forever. They would remember him now, whoever he was, whatever he had done. "And far and near, through vale and hill, are faces that attest the same, the proud heart flashing through the eyes at sound of Rob Roy's name. A year later, she would find herself obsessively revising 150 words she had written about this experience. The grave, the daffodils, the peeing in the glen, the church that was just a door in the air. But she could not make it mean anything, and she did not know why. He was a property brother, she said in the end, and put one of her stones on the name on the grave. On Isle Marie, local tradition held that insanity could be cured by towing someone around the island behind a boat. Oh, good, she thought, easy. But local tradition also held that nothing must ever be taken from the island, be it even a pebble from the shore, lest the insanity formerly cured there return to the outside world. Oh no, she thought, hard. Isla Marie was famous for the wish tree, an oak that had been hammered so full of pennies that it had died of copper poisoning. Many things still stood that way, hammered full of wishes. A certain percentage of the people now visiting Scotland appeared to be sex tourists. Her husband was one of them, and he insisted that they stop at the Clava Cairns to see the standing stones. It's not a full ring, he told them with resignation, but we'll take what we can get. The stones were supposed to carry you back in time, and she had hardly laid a hand on the tallest one before she felt herself back in time, casting a shadow to say 3 o'clock. Cows stood fogged on the opposite hillside, still belonging to the Bronze Age. The sky touched the tops of their heads, like the corner of the ceiling in her sister's house, where the breathing still went on. It was the last real day. It was the cairn she walked into with its heart dug out. It was the party of Victorians she stared at for a long time on the informational plaque. They were happy. They had done a good day's work with pickaxes and cucumber sandwiches. The sun had consented to fall, for a time, through the particular patterns of their lace. It was terrible to be a tourist, she thought. But after death, you didn't feel like a tourist anymore. You were a current of the air. You went everywhere, into people's mouths and out. Oh, my God, I think I found it, she said, going through her photos. She'd been sure that it had happened between pictures, but when she went back, she could pinpoint the moment her sister had set the scarf and the phone down. Her dark and wind-whipped figure turned away, facing into the distance, toward the foot of the Black Coulin Mountains. Giants heaved above her, and she was small. And there it was, a loose little heap of pattern behind her, and the glint of the rose-gold phone. I can't believe we got it back, her sister said softly, spreading two fingers apart to zoom in. When they finally made it into range and called the number, she had to be the one to call. Her husband was driving, her sister couldn't speak, and her mother's jeans were wet. Someone actually answered, as her husband all along had promised would happen. I have it, the woman said. It's safe. She was driving it to the police station in Portree at that moment. The child on her lap with a triangle of face showing. I love you, she said simply to the woman on the phone, who had understood her perfectly. An American would never, her husband said, happy. He had scored another point in the game. But her breath would not stay inside her, as if it were pushing the wind. I begged them to give it back, and they did. There is an exchange, she thought. Something passes between this life and the next that allows you to be here for a while. The fairy pools don't look the same on the way down as on the way up. And you walk through this world only once. She had drunk the coldest water in the world and thrown it up again green. No one could say she hadn't really been here. In her head, she signed the petition for Scottish independence. In her head, she signed the petition for Urnbru to be sweet again. In her head, she stacked a cairn. In her head, she lifted the hard heart out of a grave. the last thing she would do before she left Scotland was to stumble out of her hotel in a straight line like a sleepwalker and set the stone with the ring of mica in the knot hole of a tree. Not understanding why she was doing it, crying when she realized it was gone. She walked through the world. The exchange rate stood. Everyone must pay. As usual, I'll end with some poetry. This one from the December 22nd, 2025 issue of The New Yorker. Roller Rink Nocturne by Amy Nasuku Matatil. When we try to pretend the moon moves across our faces, we get a disco ball. Lightning bolts and star-printed carpets glow fluorescent yellow and purple under black lights. When we get hungry and our hairlines wet with a song of sweat, we pool crumpled bills from our pockets and split a hot slice and a medium RC cola. If you learn to skate backward here for a few hours, you could be royalty. If someone asked you to skate during couples skate, you were Empress Legionnaire. If you could fold into a Romeo slide, cannonball, or shoot the moon, you might as well be named Supreme Leader Admiral of the Fleet. All you need is practice. When we play at night, our eyes and body don't ever forget. Our bodies remember the glide, just like a river remembers each meander. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. We'd love to hear from you. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.